Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, first term, second district DFL Congresswoman Angie Craig. When she campaigned in 2018, she spoke frequently and forcefully about health care coverage. So that's where we're going to begin our conversation. And I think your experience as a listener and as a voter and as a Minnesotan with your own health experience, whether you get it through the ACA or your employer, will be valuable to hear. So while more Americans are insured under the ACA, do you believe that health care is more affordable in your household today than it was 5 or 10 years ago? We want to talk about affordability and access to health care this morning with the Congresswoman, and your experience will be valuable to this. We stipulate more Americans are covered under the ACA. Do you believe that health care is more affordable in your household than it was 5 or 10 years ago? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. A note here, we've invited all members of the Minnesota delegation to the show for an extended interview. You can hear my conversation with Senator Tina Smith on the podcast. Congresswoman Craig, welcome. It's really good to have you here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
In your 2018 campaign against Jason Lewis, you said, Jason Lewis has had almost 2 years now to come up with any sort of fix that makes health care more affordable. Republicans in Congress haven't done anything to make health care more affordable or more accessible in this country. You hear my stipulation about the ACA has certainly covered more Americans. What have Democrats, who have been in the majority now since the midterms, been able to do to make healthcare more affordable?
Well, the question you ask, I can tell you that it's the number one topic that my constituents talk to me about. It's the price of healthcare and the affordability of prescription drugs. And I will tell you, the answer to your question to your listeners is that absolutely not. The whole conversation over the last decade with the Affordable Care Act has been about access to health care. One of the reasons I ran for Congress is because I think we have to shift the conversation to health care cost, not just health care access. And so since I've been a member of Congress, I've introduced a bill that would lower the price of premiums in the individual marketplace. And I'm proud to say it's a bipartisan bill with Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska on it. But we've got to shift the conversation to why is healthcare so expensive and how do we get it down? One of the things that we've done since House Democrats took over is we've started to focus more on how do we create generic competition on drug cost. And so stopping big drug companies from blocking generic providers from coming to the marketplace has been a very big focus of mine, so much so that the drug industry is already sending out flyers asking my constituents to essentially oppose what I'm doing. But look, I think we've got to take on the big drug companies in this country, and we've got to finally tackle the cost of health care, not just access to health care.
Okay, so you're talking about introduced bills and you're talking about a focus on this. At what point can voters expect some kind of movement on this? Because the standard you were holding Jason Lewis to was, hey, you've been in office for 2 years and you haven't done anything on this. You've had a year in the majority. Is it another year where voters can say, I expect some kind of action on this?
Well, there have been a number of bills that have already passed the House of Representatives, the CREATES Act, for example, the Blocking Act, for example. And I will tell you, there are more than 20 bills that would lower the cost of health care on Mitch McConnell's desk right now in the Senate. I can't wave a magic wand on this. I can only pass bills through the House and tell the American people what will happen if you give us the opportunity to lead. For example, right now, I have a number of folks who are attacking me because I support H.R. 3, which would require Medicare to negotiate for prescription drug costs. This is a common sense idea. Should have been done a long time ago. The VA already negotiates its costs for drugs and for medical devices. Look, I spent 20 years working in healthcare. I didn't think the ACA was perfect. In fact, I thought there were some serious unintended consequences
as
I implemented. Well, as you look at what happened inside large companies, the Cadillac tax, that's what it's referred to, these, you know, very good plans that were tagged the, you know, Cadillac tax.
Well,
taxing on high benefit health insurance plans.
Right.
What that did is it actually punished employers who offered high benefit plans to their employees. And what employers did is they shifted the cost share over the 8 years after the ACA was implemented, more toward their employees. You saw this especially, you know, labor organizations who had negotiated very good benefits, giving up pay raises to do it, all of a sudden were facing the Cadillac tax. And so there were really worse unintended consequences.
My understanding was about the Cadillac benefits packages is most rank and file workers didn't have access to that. It was mostly executives. And is that really the reason why more and more employers have shifted health care costs to employees? It's not because of the Cadillac tax, is it?
Well, I'll tell you, that is that's one of the fallacies. Is at our company, St. Jude Medical, our executives had access to the exact same benefits as our employee base did. And I will tell you that what we saw as I started to look at the data, I was the head of HR for a Fortune 500 company at the time. What we started to see is the cost shift to employees from employers started to happen at a very rapid rate after the Cadillac tax. So before the Cadillac tax, you know, maybe employees paid 20% of the benefit and your employer paid 80% of the benefit. They started shifting very dramatically. And so I think that is a fallacy that, it, you know, this only applied to executives. And if you're in a labor organization and your union has negotiated good benefits for you, your entire employer base, that's exactly what happened. So again, you know, the one thing that I agree with the president on more than anything is that healthcare is complicated and you have to look at exactly what legislation is going to do, but also what are the unintended consequences of that legislation.
Let me come back on cost sharing, but we have a lot of calls here for you, so I want to take some of them to Laura in St. Paul. Hey, Laura, thank you so much for waiting.
Hi, thank you.
What's your situation with this, your experience that you'd like the congresswoman to hear?
Living in a household with a self-employed person supporting us, we haven't had health insurance regularly for 6 years, but not at all for the last three. It costs so much more to have it that it's cheaper for us to pay as we go. We have a $10,000 family deductible.
Ouch.
And we would pay over $8,000 a year in healthcare costs.
What do you do when one of the kids or one of you needs to go to the doctor?
We pay cash.
Is this unusual, Congresswoman?
This isn't unusual at all. It isn't. And this is why we have to fight this fight no matter what the healthcare industry responds. You know, the bill I've introduced, the State Healthcare Premium Reduction Act, is exactly designed, I mean, I'm the author of this bill, to help families like this. And, you know, I hear stories of farmers in Zumbrota, in my congressional district, who are paying $24,000 a year for their family in healthcare premiums with a $12,000 deductible. Look, if healthcare is not affordable, it's not accessible. And, you know, I'm so sorry that your family is faced with this, because it shouldn't be this way in America today. And, you know, that's why we have got to take on not just the cost of health insurance, but also the cost of health care.
To Christine in West Concord, Minnesota. Hi, Christine. Thanks so much for waiting.
Good morning.
What's your experience with this?
Well, my husband and I are self-employed. We own a small business in Rochester, Minnesota, right in the heart of Mayo Clinic area. When the Affordable Care Act went into effect, our health insurance was $950 a month with a $12,000 deductible for the two of us. When the Health Care Act went into effect, Blue Cross Blue Shield kicked all the small business owners off, and our health insurance went to $1,850 a month. I then sought out other insurance forms and ended up on a Christian health share. I was admitted into Olmsted Medical Center last year, and they transferred me to Mayo Clinic by ambulance. That bill is $25,000.
Wow.
And the Christian health share refused to pay it. The tests that Mayo Clinic did were twice as much. Because of the Affordable Care Act, the Mayo Clinic has been purchasing up all the small clinics, and it is twice as much, if not 10 times as much, to have anything down here. So the state of Minnesota kind of supplemented the increased cost for the southeastern Minnesota area.
Okay, Christine, you've raised something. I want to give the Congresswoman time to answer this. Is she right in her analysis that because of what the ACA did, it provided some of the larger health organizations with the capability, as with what's happened with Mayo, to buy up some of these larger, smaller health organizations and then be the monopoly, basically, in the area?
Well, I don't know if that was exactly because of the ACA. It's you know, perhaps one of the unintended consequences is that you end up with a lot of consolidation in healthcare, which is one of the things that that I've been fighting. You know, what her story, though, is not unusual, especially in Wabasha County and Goodhue County that I represent, which is one of the reasons why I've supported opening up a public option for folks to choose to buy into. I've supported something called the Medicare Choice Act of 2019, which would give these large insurance companies more competition. And it would start in rural areas, number one, and it would allow the secretary to actually adjust payment rates in rural areas.
Secretary of Health and Human Services.
That's right.
This is different from Medicare for All. I just want to make sure.
This is certainly different from Medicare for All.
We better describe how.
Well, this is like having the government form an insurance plan that competes with the big insurance companies, but you're not forced to go into it. It's a way to provide more competition. And I think that's one of the difficulties in areas like Wabasha and Goodhue County is there's not enough competitors down there, right? And so, you know, you end up in Wabasha County and, you know, all of a sudden Mayo is out of network for you. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why we want to take on surprise billing in this country, because if you end up in an ambulance down in Mayo, it's out of your network, you know, you shouldn't have to pay an enormous amount. But there was one other element that, you know, I'd have to dig into the details to understand from her scenario, but she described a Christian organization offering health insurance. And, you know, that's one of the challenges of some of the alternatives that have emerged out there in the marketplace is often they don't actually cover what you think they cover. And so, again, the administration allowing more of these junk plans to continue to arise.
Or otherwise known as skinny plans.
Skinny
right?
plans, junk plans to continue to arise. You know, again, if your health care insurance doesn't actually cover you when you get sick, you know, why in the world would we let that exist?
What do you do, though, about the differential in the risk pool? Because you have young, healthy Americans, 30 years old, who don't feel like they need health care coverage that covers everything. They fit a kind of skinny plan, don't they?
Well, do they? I mean, the question is, can you have a functional marketplace if you don't have young, healthy people in the risk pool? You know, that's one of the reasons why an employer-sponsored plan works, is because, you know, you have, you know, employers with their young children in the plan who are not likely to get sick. So you're right. When
the riskiest people are being helped basically by the non-high risk
people.
That's right.
When Republicans in Congress started to knock several of the legs out of the Affordable Care Act. It made it less effective. Of course, one of those was the individual mandate, the mandate that you have to go get health insurance or you have a tax penalty for doing so. And backing up to all of, from all of this, did the ACA provide some, you know, good things for America? Sure. We love having, you know, personally, I have four sons and they're all, you know, between 16 and 22 year olds. We love being able to carry our children on our health plans for until they're 26. Was it a good thing that women no longer pay more than men for their health services? Absolutely. It was a good thing. But there have been some unintended consequences from the ACA. And the question is, why aren't we fixing those things? The two things I just talked about, providing, you know, reinsurance, which is the state premium reduction act that I've introduced, letting Medicare or Medicaid provide some competition to big health insurance companies. Why aren't we doing those things? I'll tell you, that's been the biggest surprise for me since being in Congress, because in Minnesota, reinsurance is a Republican idea. In fact, we barely got any Democrats to vote for it. I took this to Washington as a Democrat, introduced it, got criticized by some Democrats for doing so, and it took me over 6 months to get a Republican to sign on to the bill. And that's because healthcare in America has become so politicized. If we do anything to make the Affordable Care Act more affordable, somehow that's seen as a political loss by Republicans. And, you know, at the end of the day, there are all kinds of ways that we could stabilize America's healthcare system. I actually have most of the time stopped calling it the ACA or Obamacare. It's almost a 10-year-old healthcare law in America today. What's working? What's not? Let's fix what's not. And let's continue to make sure healthcare becomes more affordable for Americans.
You've reminded me just in describing trying to get sponsors on that bill and the criticism that when you came in and I was asking you about what it's been like in this initial year in Washington, you said the party leadership really isn't invested in having its members be as bipartisan as you'd want to be. Now, in some ways, that sounds like self-serving. Oh, I buck my party's majority because I really want to be bipartisan, because that's, for whatever reason, still the buzzword. But it is interesting to hear you say the party leadership doesn't really provide opportunities for that. Why not?
Well, they want us to vote for whatever the party is putting forward. And you know, as much
as... But you will, basically, right?
As much as you say that, people are thinking about winning the next election. They're thinking about winning the next election. And look, I'm not even comfortable today being called a politician. You know, I spent over 25 years working in the private sector. You know, I don't know how long I'll be here. And I'm in a district that's only been held by a Democrat, you know. Well, I'll put it another way. This district has been held by Republicans 69 of the last 77 years. You know, I just want to do what's right from a policy perspective for my district and for Minnesotans. And, you know, if I do that, I'll be proud of my work in this Congress. And I was saying earlier before we went on air that neither party really gives us the time to be able to spend quality time with people from across the aisle. And I was sworn in 12 days into a government shutdown that went over 35 days. And one of the, you know, maybe the only good thing that came out of that is a number of freshman Republicans and freshman Democrats came together to meet every day in the Ag Committee room, and we got to know each other. And look, I'm proud of the fact that since I've been a member of Congress, I've written 16 bills. I've sponsored, either written or sponsored over 300, and over 2/3 of them are actually bipartisan. There are Republicans and Democrats on those bills. And yeah, it sounds, you know, if you're in a room full of Democrats, I mean, you know, bipartisanship can sound like a buzzword, but if we work hard at it and we listen, really listen to each other, I believe it's possible in this country again.
Can you name an instance where you've really gotten crosswise with Nancy Pelosi or one of the leaders because you have been intentionally and deliberately bipartisan?
Yeah, I got on the wrong side of leadership when Democratic leadership decided to introduce a bill that would give Congress a pay raise within the first 6 months. And I just told you, we were sworn in 12 days into a shutdown. you know, and went 35 days. And are you kidding me? You know, the member average members of Congress make over double what a family of four in my congressional district make. And the idea that you would put yourself a pay raise in this context right now just didn't make any sense to me. So not only did I oppose the pay raise, I filed an amendment to have it stricken from the appropriations bill. And I can tell you that that got leadership's attention.
Did you notify leadership before you were going to do that to say, look, I just want you to know what I'm doing and here's the reason I'm doing it? Or were they blindsided by it?
Look, I always let my leadership know.
Okay.
What
so
I'm
they
doing.
Knew this was coming.
Yeah, I called them before. We had already written the amendment and we're ready to file it. And I called leadership and said, this is coming. This won't make any sense to my constituents. And, you know, I know it sounds a little bit like a buzzword or sort of political speak, but I was sent here to represent the people of the 2nd Congressional District. That's it. That's all. Right? That is it. And, you know, I have spent a ton of my time in the southern part of my district because I'm on the Ag Committee and because I represent 95% of my farmers are family farmers in this district. And I was sent there to represent everyone, whether they voted for me or not. And, you know, that's going to mean sometimes I'll agree with the president and the administration. Sometimes I'll disagree with Democrats. And, you know, if I can build a record of just representing the constituents in this district, I'll reapply for my job and I'll see what happens.
Second District Congresswoman Angie Craig is in the studio with us this morning. She has to leave in about 20 minutes to go to a Veterans Day memorial service today. So we're going to let her go. But in that time, we're hoping to get as many questions in as we can on health care and now on some other issues, since we've covered health care for a bit this morning. What do you want to know about the bills that she's sponsoring, the ideas that she supports? What do you want to tell her about your own experience that you think should inform the way she represents Minnesota and her district? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Cam says, if we didn't have to make financial payments on student loans from grad school, it would make more financial sense to decrease our income to qualify for MA, and that would also make it easier for me to seek care without fearing expensive labs and tests. Student loans. This comes up every time someone is in the studio talking about the big issues that preoccupy voters' minds. What are you interested in trying to do about this? What has the leadership indicated that they are committed to?
Well, I think this is an opportunity for us to rethink how we think about secondary education in this country. One of the biggest focus areas for me as a member of Congress has been how do we make sure that young people know that there are great opportunities for a good life in the trades and in technical education. So Senator Tina Smith and I just introduced the 21st Century Workforce Partnerships Act. This is a bill that would allow local high schools and tech schools to partner with local employers to make certain that young people know, here's some great jobs that you can go into that don't require a four-year college degree. I think one of the greatest disservices we've done to our young people is sort of build this idea that everyone should go to college. You know, my wife Cheryl and I, we have four sons. Our oldest son went to tech school. He's doing great. He's working in advanced manufacturing. He's almost 22 years old, and he was the kid who loved to work with his hands. But as parents and as schools and from a policy perspective, we've sort of built into our kids' minds that somehow you're a failure if you don't go to a four-year university. Well, guess what? 30% of kids who go actually complete a four-year college. So before I get to student loans, I just have to say I think we have got to go back in our secondary education systems and make sure that students objectively know what their opportunities are to earn a good life? Because isn't that the point of post-secondary education? And with that, you know, I do think we should be increasingly funding Pell Grants in this country for needy students. Look, I don't support, you know, free four-year college, and sometimes I get beat up for that.
And the reason for that is?
Well, look, we middle-class families, I don't believe, should pay for college for people who can afford it. And at the end of the day, I believe a two-year technical degree or 2 years of community college should be something that we consider paying for in this country to make sure that people come out of secondary school with a work skill that they can contribute and start paying taxes to. And in addition, for needy students, to help level the playing field, we should increase Pell Grants.
You think colleges have gotten greedy, that these tuitions, which we know are rising much faster than the cost of living, much faster than inflation. What's the purpose for that? What's the reason for it?
Well, I've asked that to almost every college I've ever visited. And to be honest, I still don't understand exactly why the cost of college continues to go up. I think we have to make sure that we're prioritizing the right things in universities today. And then I think the other truth of the matter is that states in another generation used to actually subsidize our state colleges more. Look, I grew up in a mobile home court. The daughter of a single mom with three kids. I wouldn't be sitting here today if not for affordable public state college. I could work two jobs and put myself through college. You can't do that in this country today, and that requires us to rethink higher education. It requires us to rethink public policy around post-secondary education.
Call here from Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to ask if the Congresswoman would support making student loans dischargeable under bankruptcy again. That helped a lot of people, and I think it would also put the onus on lenders before they just start lending out all this money. They decide to lend it only in cases where they know they're going to get paid back. Student loans were dischargeable under bankruptcy until the first term of President Clinton in the early 90s. Before that, you could discharge a student loan under bankruptcy like you could anything else. That would really help a lot of these struggling kids.
Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we ought to take a strong look at that. I talk to young people all the time who, you know, they're delaying their first house, their, you know, a new car, and I met a young couple at the Dakota County Fair, and they were delaying their first child. I mean, you think about just the economic impact of student loans today. It's pretty extraordinary.
To the phones, to Carol in Minneapolis. Hi, Carol. Carol, I really appreciate you waiting. Are you there?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. I know it's been a while. Thanks so much. Your question for the Congresswoman. Sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that in the last 10 years, back to healthcare, my healthcare has been improved in kind of small but significant ways. I am a mom of two kids. I've had them both in the last 5 years. And I also have had mental health care and reproductive care. And I used to be on public assistance to afford my birth control. And now they cost me nothing, which is great. My births were complicated, and I had to pay very little out of pocket. And my insurance used to limit the number of mental health care visits that I had. And now I don't have those limits, and I don't have to pay out of pocket for those.
So you're saying the ACA has been overall a benefit, and your health care costs you less?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. You know, you mentioned contraception care. This is something I wanted to come back to, Congresswoman, about drug costs, because your campaign platform said this about drug costs. We must also rein in out-of-control costs in the pharmaceutical industry. We can start by making pharma compete by negotiating with Medicare, you've said that, and ensure that generic drugs are an important part of the healthcare mix. This is something that President Trump is committed to. Sometimes his attention wanes and waxes on it, but it's something that he seems to come back to through his first term. Tell me why House Democrats have not seized the opportunity to actually get something done on drug prices, given the polling that we see, given the president's interest, and given what you've said this morning.
Well, it is stunning, actually, because this is one of the stunning that the president says this, and yet every time we introduce legislation that would accomplish this, he backs away from his promises. You know, H.R. 3 is a great example, negotiating on Medicare drug pricing. The president committed to this during his first election and yet has not been willing to actually take on the drug companies when the rubber meets the road. This is an area where we ought to be able to find common ground. He's done the same thing on transportation and infrastructure in terms of an infrastructure bill. He's done a little bit of the same thing on this topic of, supporting our family farmers versus, oil executives. So, look, I'm ready to work with the president to reduce drug pricing.
Just so I understand this. So you're saying that although the president has repeatedly expressed interest and a commitment mm-hmm. to this, that when there's an opportunity and House Democrats are pressing on this, the president says no. Because I guess what I'm questioning is, are House Democrats as invested on giving him a win as you sound like you are?
Well,
because in this zero sum game kind of game of politics there, that's how it would be seen, right?
Well, I can tell you on H.R. 3 in particular, that piece of legislation adopted, some of the thoughts of the administration with the idea that we want to come back to our constituents and say, we got this done for you. And that's the nature of compromise. You know, we've got the Blocking Act, the CREATES Act, all of these bills that would create more generic competition in drug pricing, because, that's one of the challenges is, a biosimilar, which is a really expensive drug. If you look at, my own experience of having run the health plan, it was 2% of the volume of our drugs and it was 40% of the cost. These
Wow.
are the really, incredible biologics. They're wonderful. We've got bills that have passed the House. They're sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk right now that would increase competition in that marketplace. And, if the president really wanted those bills, he would call Mitch McConnell and he would say, pass those bills so I can sign them into law and I can take this back to America and say, we got this done. So, I am incredibly disappointed that we haven't been able to get some of the bills that have passed the House to lower prescription drug costs through the Senate and ultimately signed into law. But I'm going to keep working toward it.
As Second District Congresswoman Angie Craig in the studio with us. If you've just gotten in on the conversation, we've covered health care. We've talked about student loans and we're opening up the phone lines for other concerns that you have. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and she has to leave in about 10 minutes to make another engagement. So get your call in quickly to Nancy in St. Paul. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi. What'd you want to say to the Congresswoman?
Well, I just wanted to give her a chance to clarify a comment she made about not having her constituents pay for tuition for college students,
okay.
Other people's kids, I guess, because I always felt that we should all pay for education of everyone because we all benefit from having educated people in our society and the jobs they do that help us. And so I wanted to find out if she, how she felt about, not only public education for younger people, but helping college students pay for their education because they do contribute to her constituents when they graduate and get good jobs.
That idea of the common good, yes.
Well, and that's why I believe that we should be rethinking our post-secondary education system. But the plan I support goes so far as 2 years of technical school, of community college, of state public college. It doesn't cover the entire cost. Look, if your family is able to participate and contribute some toward higher education, based on needs, I think we ought to allow that to continue for that, third and fourth year. But I do think that in order to even begin level the playing field, that we ought to rethink those first 2 years of post-secondary.
A question for you about, again, your new experience here as a member of Congress. Candidly, how much time during the week do you spend raising money? Just be honest with me.
Too much. Too much. I spend too much time.
Is it part of your day each day, or is there time that you reserve for the end of the week, or how do you manage it?
It depends on the week. And the weeks are 7 days, you know, that's how my weeks go. So, you know, candidly, 10 to 15 hours a week.
Wow. Making phone calls for 10 to 15 hours a week.
Absolutely. 10 to 15 hours a week. And, you know, that's, you know, not every member of Congress has to do that. If you're in a district, that is safe Democratic or safe Republican, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you know, you raise, you'll be reelected. But when you're in a swing district, when you're a frontline candidate, when you are being targeted by the other party for your seat, if you can't get your message out, if you can't refute, frankly, what will be the distortions of your record, you won't be able to communicate to your constituents.
So you're talking about money for advertising.
I'm talking about
what you
advertising.
Really mean.
Yeah,
it's TV ads, right?
It's TV ads. It's digital ads. It's being able to combat the distortions about your record. And, you know, this has all been exacerbated by Citizens United, which I support a constitutional amendment to overturn, or more transparency for super PACs. You know, the people of Minnesota ought to know when brand name drug companies are running ads against me and why, right? We ought to know who's funding those super PACs.
I want to ask you about that since you've talked about campaign funding. You take much more campaign money from large individual donors and PACs than you do from small donors. Do you know what the ratio is?
Well, I can tell you that in 2018, when I won my seat in Congress, the average contribution was $33 per person. I don't know what my averages are right now, but I can tell you it was pretty good.
So right now, the ratio is 86% large donors and PACs to 11.8% small donor contributions. I just want you to know that I went to the opensecrets.org website. So if anybody's wondering about my sourcing on this, when experts talk about the influence of money in politics, they talk about large individual donors and PACs. You don't sound like the way you talk about the way you raise money during the campaign does not sound like what's actually happening since you've been in office for a year, given that ratio. So where's the disconnect here?
Well, I tell you, over the course of a campaign, what you typically see is grassroots giving in the on year. And during the course of fundraising, what you typically see is the people who supported you the first time around, or in my case, two times around before I won the seat, come back early with their support. And the idea for that is frankly, you know, I'm the stronger I am from a financial perspective, the more likely I am to ward off strong competitors in my next election.
So,
that's the theory anyway.
So that ratio, you're okay with that? The large individual donors and the PACs versus the grassroots that you just described that happened during the campaign?
Well, I can tell you that I'm very, very excited about the ability to bring back the grassroots support that I had in 2018 that resulted in that $33 per contributor,
that
average.
The way you're saying this leads me to believe you're a little uncomfortable with the ratio where it is right now, or no?
No, I'm happy to
bring on the PACs and the large individual donors.
You know what? Bring on the opportunity to communicate, and let's step back because HR1 was probably the most important bill that we've passed since I've been a member of Congress. And again, it's gathering dust on Mitch McConnell's desk right now, that will create substantial change in our campaign finance system. But we're not there yet. And at the end of the day, I've got to compete with a Republican on a level playing field. And as long as the rules are what they are, I'm going to continue to work to ensure that I have the resources to compete in 2020.
Let me take one last call for you here before you have to go to Kim in Prior Lake. Hi, Kim. Your question for
Hi.
The Congresswoman. Hi.
Yes. Hi. So my question is, you know, based on the fact that Mitch McConnell is, like, basically stymieing all bills that come through, do you think that term limits would make getting bills through easier? Do you think that there would be less issues between the parties if there were term limits. I have never been a proponent of term limits in the past, but I'm beginning to think that that might be the way to stop the craziness that's going on in Washington.
It's interesting how this idea comes back around every few years, isn't it?
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, my term is limited to 2 years unless the people of the second congressional district send me back to Washington. And, you know, that's why I've been focused on the people in our district, right? The cost of health care and the price of prescription drugs, trying to support the president's push for an infrastructure bill, special education funding, which is dear to my heart and I haven't been able to talk about, and supporting our family farmers.
To Kim's question specifically, yes, you're limited if voters don't approve it, vote for you again. But overall, do you think there ought to be a limited number of times that somebody can serve in consecutive terms?
I'm torn on it because, you know, I love Amy Klobuchar as my senator, and I'd like to see her as my president. I've endorsed Amy for the presidency. And the question is, you know, would we want to limit someone like Amy serving in the U.S. Congress, who is, you know, who's been able to create bipartisan support for her bills in a way that's really extraordinary? So I'm torn on term limits. But at the end of the day, what I think you'll find, and I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but you know, a lot of folks over the last 10 years have been removed from the Congress. You know, that 2010 election, which saw so many Democrats leave. Frankly, what I'd prefer to see, and I'll be in trouble with my Democratic leadership later today on this, is more limits on the amount of time that Democrats can serve in leadership. I think the Democratic Party would be well served to see, more of a rotation.
Nancy Pelosi stepping down? Is
well,
that what you're saying?
I'll take Nancy Pelosi right now every day. But what I'm saying is that when you get to Congress and you got to wait 30 years in Congress to ever have an opportunity to serve in leadership, you know, I've never worked in a system sort of in business out in the real world where, you know, 25 years working in healthcare. Growing up without health insurance in my own family didn't make me a healthcare expert just because I'm not on the right committee for that. You know, so again, I at the risk of getting myself in trouble with Democrats, I think, we should look at how long, a leadership could serve.
Hate to let you go. Know you have to go. Thank you so much for the time. Good to have you here, and please come back.
Thank you, Carrie.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.